been sitting
on my
desk.
Conference will...
This article has been sitting on my desk for about a month now. Al Bala brought it up in one of his conference calls that he did, talking about impacting lives and making a difference in the world and all that kind of stuff. And he reads prolifically like I do, and the minute he mentioned this article, it's published in the Harvard Business Review. It's by one of the professors at Harvard University, Clayton Christensen, who happens to be a Christian. He read it, and he loved it, and he talked about it. Oh, Lydia. Oh, one last announcement. I'm sorry. The old Manatech website is going away officially on the 7th of August. So know that you know, if you haven't shifted to the new website, make sure you're shifted and you get used to it this week. Spend your time and energy around that. Get off of that old website because it won't be available as of August 7th, okay? So everybody familiar with that, that's important because you're going to have some people that fall off the plateau if they go back there and they can't find it because it will not be available. All right. Thanks, Lydia. Okay, back to our article. So the article that Al highly suggested it, it's not available. You can't find it on the Internet unless you pay for it, just like many of those periodicals. You have to go in and pay a price for them. I'm not sure Lydia paid a price for it. I don't know what that price was, so I can't tell you what it is. But if you wanted to get a copy of it, you could go to Harvard Business Review. It's www.hbr.org. That's their website. Harvard Business Review, they use their first letters and those three words. And you could pay whatever price that is. Usually they're around 10 or 12 bucks, but whatever that is for you. Or you can just listen to get your outline for today's call and listen to my talk this morning, and you will have everything that's in that article. It's not a lengthy article. It's only about 10 pages long, I think. Well, not even that. How's that? 6 pages long. But very small print, so it contains a lot of stuff. Anyway, I'm going to talk about that this morning. I think it's a great thing to review, and it gives us some highlights. And to me, it's really was a lot of fun because it took management principles and applied them to our day in and day out life, which I found very fascinating. Because I've been in the management arena, of course, I've run my own companies in the past, and been in the legal field in corporate America for many years. So it was exciting to see somebody take the business philosophies and models and apply them to our personal lives. So we're going to kind of go through a little bit of that today and see how it applies in your life, and you can see the kind of distinctions that are drawn there. So it's in the article is entitled, How Will You Measure Your Life? And this fits so well because we're working recently, you know, with all our social entrepreneurship and all of us taking on global malnutrition. All of this kind of has a huge play in our life about what is our meaning, what is our purpose, what are we doing here, and following that in our heart instead of, you know, chasing money or chasing success in different ways. It's how we define success and recalibrating what our world view is. And nothing better than recalibrating your worldview by spending 2 weeks in the mission field, right? Exactly. So anyway, let's talk about this article, and I'll just go through the principles that he outlines and kind of how he approaches this, which, again, I found very, very fascinating. Hopefully you'll enjoy it as well as you can apply it to your life. He kicked off by talking about disruptive technology. He would... Clayton Christensen, who's the author, and I'll either call him author or Clayton as I go through the book. But as he goes through his book, he talks about, I mean, his article, he talked about his life of giving consult. He used to be a big, huge consultant to businesses out there, and he would go in and he would talk about this disruptive technology. And you and I have heard that terminology for years because we heard that term when we applied what glycobiology was, and I thought that was kind of fascinating that here is this term that we've been using to describe glycobiology in the realm of the nutrition industry and alternative health, and the idea that it's very disruptive because it's about how the body can heal itself inherently and utilize these nutrients and nutrients that we had never discovered before called glyconutrients. But as he utilized the word disruptive technology, he had written a paper. In fact, it's I think it's The Innovator's Dilemma was a paper, or it was about a paper about disruptive technology, and he was asked how this applies by the head of Intel. That was one of his companies that he worked for. And so he started describing how it works, and the guy was very impatient, you could tell. But he kept asking him for 10 more minutes. And instead of telling or answering his question about, you know, what Intel needed to do to really be more effective in their marketing, he basically talked about his model, about how they attacked it, and he just used a different industry. He took the steel industry, and he said, here's what we did, our team, to understand how disruption works. How does the process of disruption in a different industry, and he applied it to the steel industry. And he did that by talking about how the steel mini mills had begun attacking the lowest end of the market. So they started looking at steel reinforcing bars or rebar, and then gradually worked up to a higher end. So it was disruptive technology applied at the most minimal level, the lowest end of the marketplace. So through that, the Intel president was able to take that application of the model and apply it to his specific circumstances and come up with the best possible solution for Intel. And it was a lesson in learning about how you want to teach people how to think, not give them answers and solutions to their own problems, because they inherently have more information about their own problem themselves because they've lived in it. They have more technology, they have more strategies, they have more information because they've been living in that environment and probably running companies for 20 years. They might have been working for the same company for 10 years. They have more product knowledge. So the idea is to teach them how to think in approaching their problem, and they will come up with the better solution than you could at any moment and any time. And so Clayton kind of did the same thing. He's teaching people how to take good management theory, how it's built, you know, in terms of applying different theories, attach different models or theories that help students think about the various dimensions of how a manager's job is in terms of stimulating innovation and growth. So that's the whole backbone behind that is applying models to, again, stimulate innovation and growth. And on the last day of Clayton's classes, he would take those same models and he'd tell people to apply them to turn those theoretical lenses on themselves to find answers to three major questions in their lives. And this is how Clayton teaches at Harvard Business School. So he says, take the models and apply them in these theoretical lenses and apply them to answer three questions in your life. And I put those questions in the article. Number one, how can I be sure I will be happy in my career? And number two, how can I be sure my relationships with spouse and family become an enduring source of happiness? And the third question was, how can I be sure that I'll stay out of jail? And he really doesn't mean stay out of jail, but in other words, how can I ensure myself or be sure that I live a life of integrity? So you can put it in that phraseology as well, if that works more effectively for you. I kind of like the idea of how to live a life of integrity is important. And those are the three principles that he would have people take all their theoretical lenses, disruptive technology, all the models, and apply them to their life, so that they can accomplish answers to those questions. And it kind of sets up a case study in and of itself. And one of the theories that he had is a business theories in terms of giving insight into the first question, which is how can I be sure I will be happy in my career? He used Frederick Hertzberg, who asserted that the most powerful motivator in our lives is not money. And we know that already. We've learned that in Manatech. We've learned that over the years because we looked at the three major motivators. And it's, the number one is being a part of something greater than you. In other words, purpose, being a part of something like social entrepreneurship, like being a part of global malnutrition. That's our greatest motivator. Another one is recognition, that we get recognition, you know, growth and learning. And then money only comes down the pike. But he says we need to Hertzberg recognizes that the most powerful innovator in our lives is not money. It's the opportunity to learn, grow in responsibilities, contribute to others, and be recognized for achievements. And we see contribute to others and recognize for achievements. Those are the ones that we've heard of in the past, too. Contribute to others being part of something greater than us, a purpose, and being recognized for achievements is that recognition part of it, that's a big motivator for us, as well as we have opportunity to learn and grow in responsibilities. So if those are truly our motivators, right, if those are our motivators in our life, is that what really drives us as people, then in management theory, is it not something that we should take into account when we work with people, that we make sure that we open up those opportunities for people to be a part of that process? So he took it one step further. He said, like, what if you're in an employment position, and many of you can look at your jobs today, if you have jobs, and if you're working in a place where you don't have the opportunity to learn, you're not growing in responsibilities, you're not finding that your job contributes to others, or you're not being recognized for achievements that you have, then what is the impact that has on your life? Well, the impact on your life is you start feeling totally unappreciated, unimportant, and that you're stuck. And, you know, we look at the statistics today about how many people are feeling exactly that response in their jobs today. And when you feel those things, what kind of person do you become when you come home? How does this affect your beingness with your kids and your spouse? It totally impacts it because you feel shortchanged, underutilized, underappreciated. All of these things carry home and totally change your attitude around your environment at home and everywhere else because it robs from you as a person. So it's incredible. Now, taking that same individual, put him into an environment that has continuous learning daily, getting more and more responsibilities as you grow in your business opportunity, pouring into others, in other words, and getting the opportunity to contribute to the success of other people on the team as well as yourself, and getting acknowledged for the accomplishments the team makes. Now, how does that person come home? And how are they with their spouse and their children and their church life and their neighborhood and their social environment everywhere else? Totally different human being. So he looks at this as a concept of how can I be sure I'll be happy in my career? Well, it's finding yourself in a position where you have all those things, and when you get into management, as Harvard teaches these kids going into management, how can you as a leader provide this atmosphere for people? Because management is truly the most noble of all professions, because management in and of itself can offer the ability to impact people on all of these levels. You can be a manager that opens all these levels up to people, or you can be a manager that shuts them down. But you acknowledge now that these are the things that truly motivate people and bring happiness in their lives. So the idea is, how do you build that in your environment? It's fascinating because it's a management theory of, you know, and you can look at how it applies in management, but it also applies for us in ManaTech, because each and every one of us is our own leader. Each and every one of us has our own organization. We have our own group of associates that we lead, guide, and direct every single day. We try to get people motivated, right? And sometimes we like to throw the comp plan and get people totally motivated on money. Well, we know that money's not our number one motivator. So is comp plan important? Of course, for people who want to survive and they want to live off of their ManaTech income, that's going to be important as a base. But this is intriguing. It shows to me why so many people stay so convicted around ManaTech, no matter what their base income is, because they have the opportunity. It's, you know, ManaTech presents itself through all the vehicles we have, my Monday calls, all the training exercises we do. We have a tremendous opportunity to continue to learn, all the books we read, the book reviews that we keep growing as people, self-development. So we're constantly in that realm of opportunity of growing as people, and that we want to stay there. Remember Mary Jo's whole philosophy about, you know, you're either green or growing or you're ripe and rotting, your choice. So you want to stay in the green and growing mode, and that's the opportunity to learn that keeps positive attitude and positive momentum and happiness. You grow in responsibilities. As you grow in your ManaTech business, you get more and more people underneath you, then you get more and more responsibilities because you are taking on more and more of a leadership role. So you continue to grow in the responsibilities. You then can start taking on local responsibilities for your area, for area meetings, area growth. You can take on more national responsibilities by becoming on the advisory council of ManaTech or whatever direction you want to go with that. So it's about, you know, growing in responsibilities around us, contributing to others. How are you on a daily basis pouring into your downline? How am I contributing into others? Not enabling them, empowering people. Because remember, contribution to others is about how we're helping people lift them up to a higher level and be a better, and how to be better themselves. How do we help other people improve and grow And then recognize people for achievements. We have huge recognition programs in Manitech. That's why we have leadership levels. We have recognition at all the national events and regional events because it's important for people to get recognized for the achievements they've created. So how are you behaving in that regard? You can look at these different characteristics under Hertzberg's theory of management, and you can apply under a 3A in the outline and just say, okay, what am I doing in my growing in this business? How are these things applying to my leadership in my own organization to help, again, ensure that people are happy in their, not just their career, but in our regards, would be happy in their Manitech business, growing their Manitech business. So in all that's, like, again, intriguing from a management perspective, applying management standards and management concepts to what we do in Manitech to get the same kind of results. Theory that is helpful in answering question number two, of course, our question number two is, how can I be sure my relationship with a spouse and family become an enduring source of happiness? And one of the most important things here is we look at how strategy is defined and implemented in our lives. How is strategy defined and implemented? See, most companies apply decision-making systems. They're based to steer their investments to initiatives that offer the most tangible and immediate returns. In other words, looking for immediate results. Again, this is a lack of patience. Why do we look for immediate results? Because so many companies, especially in our management realm and the business world, are looking for, you know, positive financial results for purposes of the stock, their stock being publicly traded. And they're judged based on the value of the stock, so they're really tied into immediate, most tangible and immediate returns. And this can result in shortchanging investments and initiatives that are crucial for long-term strategies. Like if a long-term strategy of British Petroleum would have been to protect the Gulf of Mexico, it wouldn't have mattered to them their deadline so much on getting that well, you know, in place and up and producing. But instead, their short-term directives were so powerful that they cut corners and did all sorts of things to get that well up and operating to produce income versus protecting the environment. It depends on what their strategy is. So your strategy is short-term. You know, when you're looking for short-term and immediate returns, you're going to lose out. You're going to come up short. You're going to end up, you know, losing out on things that matter the most to you. And in his analysis, Clayton talked about looking at Harvard grads taking on that same approach. We take on that same perspective a lot. And to me, I can relate to it because I went through law school, and immediate out of law school, what you want to do is get the best possible job you can, producing the most income. You know, and a lot of times, we don't always look for public service environments because that's not where the money is. But you're a starving student for so long through 4 years of undergrad, 3 years of law school, all of a sudden you're going, finally I want to try to support myself with some income, right? So we go after the highest and best job. We look at the highest and best income approach instead of, you know, looking at what really matters to you. So we sacrifice some of that in looking at highest and most tangible immediate returns in our lives. And when he looked at the Harvard's business grads, you know, those people are so high-powered. When they go to Harvard Business School, not just anyone is accepted, though. Those people are totally motivated to change the world, make a difference, and really get into top-notch jobs. You know, these guys are coming out like Chelsea Clinton's husband, Mark Mervinsky, who makes $4 million a year as a hedge fund. These are the kind of jobs that these people come out of Harvard Business School and go after. So, you know, but they're so driven for those kind of results in their life. They're so driven, and they're so driven to find top-notch jobs that they fall into jobs they're working 70 hours a week. It's pretty incredible what kind of time people put into those kind of jobs. I know getting out of law school, taking a job at the best law firm, I mean, I was putting in, you know, I never had a day less than 10 to 12 hours. I worked every Saturday. My only day off was Sunday. I mean, sometimes I'd find myself getting home at 11 o'clock at night, going back to work at 6 in the morning. I mean, it was pretty crazy. And this wasn't just for a special project. It was like week in, week out, week in, week out. And so you're going after these initiatives. You're putting in your energy, and you're putting in all your initiative into things that produce the most tangible and immediate returns. But if you have a family and you have a spouse and you have children, the price they pay is huge. So he talked about these Harvard grads coming back to business school 10 years later. They're unhappy, divorced, alienated from their children, and they wonder why. And the reality is that they got off base. They left a long-term purpose or a long-term strategy didn't exist in their life. They took short-term strategies in their life. Short-term, immediate, get the money, buy the house, buy the this, the short, like a lot of people do today. If they want to buy things today, they don't think about long-term strategy. How am I going to pay it off? You know, it's credit card instead of, you know, so it's not a long-term strategy. It's a short-term, how do I get this today? Can I make my dollars fit this moment in this time in my life? Versus putting money aside and building an investment account and building funds for their future and for retirement, not like how do I live today? So we can see this applying in many different levels. And as Clayton said, he said one of the most important things we need to do and one of the most important things he ever did in his life is when he got into grad school and he was studying econometrics and all this highly sophisticated stuff, he made sure that he dedicated an hour reading, thinking, praying about why God put him on this earth. And he's quoted in his article, he said, it's the single most useful thing I've ever learned. And he had to taking an hour out of his time of studying in his econometrics and all the things he was doing was very difficult because he felt like he might be getting behind other people that because it's very competitive. But he said, it was the most important thing I ever did in my life. It's the most useful thing I've ever learned. Because he says he applies what he learned about his purpose in life, he applies every day of his life. Versus what he learned in grad school, which he might apply two or three times a year in his life. So what's more important to you on a long-term basis, what you utilize every day of your life. So one of the quotes out of the article that I thought was so insightful was the one he said, the choice and successful pursuit of a profession is but one tool for achieving your purpose. But without a purpose, life can become hollow. And that's exactly what he's saying, that the purpose is what we need to have that long-range perspective. So just like he compared it to businesses. You know, businesses that make those short-term determinations and they invest in short-term, they're the ones that fall apart and go under because they don't have a long-term strategy. You've got to start making sure that you're investing in your long-term strategy. So what would that mean with your spouse and your relationship with your kids? Of course, investment of time and energy, because now he talks about what are our resources. How do we make those investments? We make those investments with the resources we have. Time, energy, and talent are our resources. So you want to allocate those resources. You don't. Most Harvard grads allocate them unconsciously to short-term perspective because activities that yield the most tangible accomplishments. And we can look at that because when we look at a job, how do we see, you know, how do we see, why is it so natural for us to put all that into a job? Or because careers provide the most concrete evidence that we're moving forward. Like if you ship a product or you finish a design or complete a presentation or close a sale or teach a class or publish a paper or get paid, get promoted, all these things are immediate, right? They're immediate accomplishments, the most tangible accomplishments, the most immediate response we get. In contrast, however, is investing time and energy, taking our resources and putting them into our relationship with our spouse and children, which typically doesn't offer that same immediate sense of achievement. It's more like maintaining status quo. Kids misbehave every day. You know, we have to teach them and we'll teach them over and over and over again. It's not until 20 years down the road that you can really put your hands on your hips maybe and say, I raised a good son or raised a good daughter. So you're not getting that, what, the most immediate and tangible accomplishments aren't evident in investing in your spouse and your children. And when you neglect your relationship with your spouse and your children on a day-to-day basis, it doesn't seem as if things are deteriorating. Yet all of a sudden, 5 years, 10 years down the road, you're getting a divorce. Because again, a relationship is like a plant. It needs to be watered. It needs to be nourished. It needs to be fertilized. But if we don't get immediate results or immediate accomplishments, tangible accomplishments from that, we tend not to see that necessity of that investment. So if you study the root causes of business disasters over and over, you're going to find that this predisposition toward endeavors that offer immediate gratification occurs over and over again in business disasters. Immediate gratification is what it's at the core, the predisposition. And the same thing we see in looking at personal lives. People allocating fewer and fewer of their resources to the things that they once would have said mattered most to them, but they lose perspective. So fascinating. Same as business, same as personal life, what goes on in our lives. So he also looked at creating a culture, how important it is to create a culture around our lives. They create corporate cultures, and you've heard of this many. There are books written on corporate culture, you know, From Good to Great, and all these kind of, there's tons of books out there on different corporate cultures. Servant leadership culture, like at Southwest Airlines. There's just awesome number of great, you know, books out there regarding, building a corporate culture. Because the reality is that being a visionary isn't enough. You can have somebody who's a visionary who's heading up the company, but you have to have the ability to persuade employees who might not see the changes ahead to work cooperatively to take the company in the new direction. So because not everybody's a visionary. If they don't see it, if you can't communicate that vision and get it driven in people's heads, then you don't have that camaraderie and loyalty and consensus of employees to move forward, even though the changes aren't necessarily, do they see how they're going to evolve into the results that the visionary has. So, and culture becomes very important when coercion becomes a must if you don't have culture. Because if employees are working to get together, you want to try to get employees to work together to create culture. And power tools of coercion are the coercion, threats, punishment, so on. And a lot of you might look at jobs that you've had in the past where that's the whole thing. You've worked under that whole aura of coercion. In other words, it's always been about, you know, the potential axe will fall or what punishment's going to happen. I might lose my job. The threats are there that cause you to perform, and you're going to get the least amount of performance out of people in terms of achieving a cooperative result when that happens. So employees, the way to address that is kind of like we want to begin to grow a consensus. And he says, if employees' ways of working together to address those tasks succeed over and over, consensus begins to form, and that's the way culture is built. Ultimately, people don't even think about whether their way of doing things yields success. In other words, they don't think, listen to that, ultimately people don't think, even think about whether their way of doing things yields success. They embrace priorities and follow procedures by instinct and assumption rather than explicit decision, which means that they've created a culture. Culture is compelling but unspoken ways, dictates the proven acceptable methods by which members of the group address recurrent problems. So it defines the priority given to different types of problems, and it's a very powerful management tool. So we look at it that way. Now we can apply, let's first of all talk about culture when it comes to family life. This is why I think it's so crucial with family life to build a mission statement. If I had a young family today, I would love to have something posted in my house and have everyone in the family participate in building a mission statement. What do we represent? What do we stand for as a family? And help to build a culture and have everyone participate in making choices around what that culture is. And then you as a parent, you know, it's a lot easier to start parenting at a young age. It's, again, about immediate accomplishments and results. We don't see that all the time. We have children. I see so many children today that get their way. They make all the decisions in the world. Their parents give them all the decision-making authority when they're 2, 3, 4, 5 years old. It's unbelievable. Like when parents say to me, Mary Jo, my kid, they just eat such garbage. Like, how do I stop them from doing it? And I look at this parent and I go, who's buying it? You're giving up control to these children. Now, instead, taking a parent that's in control, you teach people how to behave respectfully towards each other, your children to love each other and be respectful of one another in an environment. Obey your parents. Honor thy parents. Follow those 10 commandments. You choose the right things to do. Make good choices as they're young. And you all of a sudden create a culture. What a difference it is when you can take that child who's raised that way as a youngster, when they hit 12, 13, 14, 15, preteen, teenage years, and you'll create the highest and best results at that time of their lives because of what you've exposed them to as a culture in your family life beforehand. So we can also look at this as a culture that we create for our own downlines. What is the culture you want for your downline? What is the culture that you want to create for your downline? You have to look at that. What do I want to build for my organization? You can apply these same principles that are applied in business in growing a culture in a business environment. How do I create that in my own downline? Well, one of the things you want to create is you want to create a sense of what? Empowerment versus enabling. So if you become the supreme enabler, what are you going to create as a culture in your organization? Enabling. And that's going to be self-destructive. It's going to be the reason why your organization never grows, because people are just enabling other people instead of empowering them. So you want to build a sense of strong self-esteem and confidence. And when, if self-esteem and confidence is important for your culture and your organization, where do we know that starts from? It starts from bite-sized success. So we don't go out there and pound into people, hey, find your fourth, you know, in your first week I want you to find four business builders. When a person fails at that, you're robbing them. Self-esteem, confidence starts crumbling. So maybe come up with something that's more reasonable. So your approach to your business builders and approach to your business is going to be such that you honor people, but you come up with things that help build their self-esteem and confidence as it comes up with respect to doing their Manatech business. And helping them not beat up on themselves and go awry. So build those characteristics. I think that's what's so much fun about it. It's saying, what do I want in my culture? I want people to love and honor each other. I want people to have mutual respect. I want them to be a team. I want to build a team atmosphere. There's some presidential out there that do a great job around this. They have their own teams, and they build a team atmosphere, and the team works together. And it's got to be something that comes from the top. You've got to instill it from the top. And that's why you want to grow that and instill that in your people. So what is your culture that you're going to create in your Manatech business? Again, choice. You got to come up with a strategy of what that culture, what kind of culture you want, and then build that throughout your organization so that it drives itself. So you don't have to use coercion, you don't have to use threats, you don't have to use all these other techniques which we know don't work very well, because especially they don't work very well when you're operating as independent associates. You don't have a club to hold over somebody because they're not an employee of you. You don't have the threat of fire or hire or fire. You don't have a lot of leverage over that person. So it becomes a different environment. You can't even rely on some of the management techniques that are out there. And that's good because they're not very effective. Because they're not going to be, they're going to be totally ineffective when it comes to running your Manatech business. So build a sense of culture in your organization. And Manatech tries to help drive that as well with the things that they do from corporate headquarters. They try to drive corporate culture. They're right now working corporate. What's corporate culture today? Part of our corporate culture is social entrepreneurship. It's about conquering global malnutrition, something that we can apply in our lives, in our Manatech business. So you can see how this business principle applies. You know, in terms of what we're doing in our business, it applies in terms of our family lives. What are we doing in establishing a culture in our family life? And maybe we don't have a culture. If you can't define a culture of what your family life is, I'm going to suggest that you start really looking at that and harnessing that as a concept. Because otherwise you become scattered. No direction. And so much of our culture is based on what? In a family environment, I'm going to suggest our culture is based on family values. What are the strengths? What are your strongest values? If your strongest values aren't permeating that atmosphere to build a culture, then you're going to open yourself to all sorts of problems with raising children and everything else in spousal relationships. Everything starts crumbling. So core values are part of that culture. And the base, probably, of all family culture. The next thing he talked about was marginal costs, making the mistake of marginal cost analysis. And this is again, a business principle as he applies it in our lives. And it answers that third question. And what's the third question we talked about up front? We talked about, how can I be sure that I live a life of integrity? And he says, avoid the marginal cost mistake. in businesses, a lot of times when you get involved in business, you're going to find when they evaluate alternative investments, they tend to ignore sunk and fixed costs. In other words, they look at themselves and they say, well, you know, we sunk a lot of money into this and this and this, but what's our marginal cost? What's it going to cost us to get a result today, not thinking about what kind of investment we've made in the past? And that marginal cost analysis helps them to make decisions that are a little more freewheeling and frees them up in different directions, because they're not stuck with what they've sunk their income and their money into, investment into in the past. Well, this kind of gives them a little bit of room to leverage off of what worked in the past, instead of guiding them to create the capabilities they will need in the future. In other words, it can be short-sighted when you rely exclusively on marginal cost analysis. If the past equals the future, then it's fine, but if it's not, then it's the wrong thing to do. So that's where you can see businesses crumbling and making problems with making decisions based on marginal cost analysis. So how does this apply when we look at our lives, the marginal cost of doing something wrong? This is really intriguing, and Clayton went into this at length because he had his own personal experience around this. And what he talks about is our marginal cost. A lot of times in our own lives, we look at things that we're doing, and we might be doing, whether it's any kind of activity that we're involved in, whether it's, you know, participating in an investment, or it's, you know, tax returns, or it's, you know, any little thing that we might be involved in, doing different church activities, involving ourselves in some social events, whatever activities we're involved in. We can look, there's a little voice in our head says, look, I know that as a general rule, most people wouldn't do this or shouldn't do this. Shouldn't do, you love the shouldn't do, live your life in shouldn't, couldn't, and all that stuff. But in this particular extenuating circumstance, I'll do it just this once. And that's the marginal cost analysis. It's the marginal cost of doing something wrong just this once always seems alluring to people. It suckers people in, and you don't ever look at where that path ultimately is headed and at the full cost that the choice entails. And this comes out in our lives in many ways. Justification for infidelity, dishonesty, and all their manifestation lies in the marginal cost economics of just this once. Again, marginal cost. We're doing a marginal cost analysis, not what it does in terms of what have we sunk our stake in? Where's my stake that I've sunk in the ground, which won't allow me to waffle on that? I came across this week in the trip to Brazil, another member of the team who is married to this, brought it up just in my head right now. She's married to a deacon, the head of the deacon board at her Baptist church. And for 14 years they were married, and marginal cost played in his life. He was on a business trip in California, and he ended up starting a relationship with another woman. Now, there's no way this guy lived a life, a walk with the Lord, became a deacon of a church, and then the head deacon of a Baptist church without having some significant investments, sunken in fixed costs, of being that person, of those values, of being a Christian, about committed to God's work. But on one business trip, a marginal cost, just this once, he let himself go, and today he's off the deacon board, out of the church, he moved to California, he's off in a totally different direction in his life. And I can't help but feel the pain that he goes through for just this once. A marginal cost analysis. Just this once, how can it be wrong? How can you know, we don't know, see the consequences of it. Now, what Clayton did is he talked about his application in his own life in this article. He talks about how he made a personal commitment to God at age 16, that even though he was a big basketball player and all these things, and he was, you know, on his way to getting a basketball scholarship at a university, At 16, he said, you know, Lord, I'm making a commitment to you that I will never play ball on Sunday. I'm going to honor God's day, the Lord's day I'm honoring. Kind of like Chick-fil-A. That's a chain of restaurants that are here in Texas. I'm not sure how far they go around the country, but they are never open on Sundays. The owner of that company, president of that company, said, we're never going to open on Sundays. We're honoring God's day. Well, that's a commitment that Clayton made at 16 years old. So he went on to go on to his university. He went to Oxford University, and this is in Great Britain, and he got to the equivalent of the NCAA tournament. Their team, 1 year, made it all the way to the NCAA tournament, equivalent in Great Britain, and made it to the Final Four. And it turned out that the championship game was scheduled to be played on a Sunday. So he had a moral dilemma that he was facing. He had made this commitment to God at 16 that he wouldn't ever play ball on Sunday. So he went to the coach and he explained his problem, and the coach was incredulous. The teammates were too, because they just couldn't believe he was a starting center, and he was saying, you've got to play. Can't you break the rule just this one time? And, of course, all the pressure in the world was upon this young guy in college who is being relied upon by his entire team about playing this game. And he went back and he prayed about it, and he got very clear that he should never break his commitment. So he didn't play in the championship game. Now, that probably cost him a lot of respect from his teammates, from his coach, from a lot of people. He probably, suffered a lot of consequences for that decision. But it is proven to him to be one of the most important decisions of his life, because his life, if he would have conceded and given in at that point in his life, it would have been one unending stream of extenuating circumstances. Because can't we always find extenuating circumstances? Had he crossed the line that one time, he says, I would have done it over and over and over in the years that followed. The lesson he learned from this is that it's easier to hold your principles 100% of the time than it is to hold them 98% of the time. In other words, once you let a crack break in on your principles, you're never going to stay at just that once. It's then going to be twice, and then it's going to be third, and then it's going to be fourth. And how true is that? So you've got to define for yourself what you stand for and draw a line in a safe place for who you are. And that's the importance of that marginal cost analysis. If you don't draw that line, then you'll end up with your life in what he calls jail. In other words, you'll be out of integrity. And integrity is the one thing you don't ever want to compromise. So, incredible story about his background and doing that. I find that incredible, that somebody being a member of basketball teams for years and playing in college basketball teams, I can't fathom facing my team telling them I can't play on a Sunday. Now, I never made the commitment I wouldn't play on a Sunday, but that would just be incredible to have gone through the repercussions that he would have felt because of that decision. So anyway, pretty awesome. But we all have to look at our lives and say, where are we letting those cracks and crevices come in that are causing us to not live that life of integrity? Very important, and same true in the business realm. And then he talked about the importance of humility. Remember the importance of humility. And I liked his little piece on humility. He wrote a few paragraphs on humility, and it was kind of cool because it was a new approach. A lot of people think of humility as denying self. And they get into it almost being self-deprecating, putting oneself down and all this kind of stuff. And he said the one major characteristic of humble people, these classes, he was asked to teach a class on humility, which is what really drove him in this area. And he said one characteristic of the most humble people stood out was that they all had a high level of self-esteem. So again, it's not about hammering yourself, pulling yourself down, self-deprecation. It's not about that at all, self-deprecating behavior or attitudes. But it's about the esteem with which you regard others. So in a comparative mode, humility comes from lifting up others around you. Humbling yourself to others is not self-deprecating. It's about taking people around you and lifting them up, which is another way of looking at humility that I thought was super. I mean, it had I haven't thought all this through, but I just when I read the article and wrote the outline, it was like that really made a lot of sense to me about the sense of humility being a sense of not self-denial or self-deprecation, but rather, you know, raising other people up and putting other people first. And of course, for a lot of us, it's putting God first and then others. I like that. It's a neat scenario to understand. That God comes first, then others, and then you. And people sometimes use the word joy as recognizing that. They say joy is an acronym for Jesus first, then others, and then you. And that's another way to look at that. But it's humility, which is what putting other people, you know, others' interests first and allowing us to humble ourselves to other people. Again, not lessening yourself, but making other people, lifting other people up. Always take the attitude in this process of humbling, and this is something I teach and train and have for years, is always take the attitude that everyone has something to offer you. Because, again, I looked at it from a perspective that each of us have totally different experiences in life, so I can't live your life. So you have a lot to offer me because your experiences in your life I will never live. And it's only through living experiences in life that we grow and learn and get more knowledge about what this life is here on earth. And it's the beauty of acknowledging that allows us to open our hearts and be so humble around other people, because each and every person then becomes somebody that has something to contribute to us. It's when you get stuck in know-it-all, or I know better, or my way's better, or this is it, or this is the only way, and all the stuff that we do that shuts us down. And now your learning curve is non-existent. You stop learning. You're stuck. You're not green and growing. You're ripe and rotting. So it's about really being open to learn and understanding. And what a wonderful experience in Brazil to be able to take this attitude on with so many people with totally, you talk about different backgrounds, oh my gosh. And what fun and joy it was to hear their stories and their lives and who they were and what's important to them. What a beautiful thing. And the learning was awesome. So, and then finally, his last thing in the end of the article, he said, he talked about his own process in life and how he was diagnosed with cancer in his life, and he overcame this disease condition, but the experience truly gave him some insight into his life. He had been looking back in his life and he had been evaluating the success that he had had, and of course his success he had been measuring in terms of how many companies he helped and how much income they made, and you know, the prominence he had achieved in terms of his life and his reputation in the business world of helping businesses solve problems and being a, you know, this guy in Harvard Business School as a teacher and all these kind of things and all this greatness. And he concluded, and that's what the last quote I put at the very end of the outline, which I thought was pretty awesome, that it said, don't worry about the level of individual prominence that you have achieved. In other words, don't focus on that level of prominence that you personally have achieved. Worry about the individuals you have helped become better people. And there's a great way of measuring your life. So, great article. Hope you guys enjoyed it. I loved a lot of the stuff that he said. It was very meaningful to me. And I know it's a little different kind of Monday morning call, but you can see how it applies in your life, in your business, in your personal life. And I hope you enjoyed the material this morning. Great article, great insight, and makes us all look at our life and maybe turn that crystal a little bit to take another peek at where we are today and what we're trying to achieve. Okay, everybody, love you all. Any questions, any last-minute issues or questions that I get from anyone in the field before we close for the day?
Yeah, Mary Jo.
Yes, Fred.
Okay. If it's possible to send out another outline what you've done on reactivations.
Uh-huh.
That might be timely.
Oh, okay. All right. So just do you mean an outline on approaching reactivations? Because people
yeah.
are thinking now. Okay. I can send.
The hour. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Good. We'll do, Fred.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, everybody, Everybody else, okay, have a great week. Don't forget, again, end of business period 8. Love you all. Have a great, great week. Lots to do. Yeah, oh, I heard somebody.
I have to have you back.
Good, I love you.
I charged your batteries again and again.
God bless you. God bless you. Amen to that. Or as they say in Portuguese, you know what they say in Portuguese? It's not amen. It's amen. 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 Yeah. Amen. 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 Okay. All right. Love y'all. Have a great week.
Love you too. Bye-bye.
Yep. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.